We've come really to the end of the book of Judges. The book of Judges is this cycle, seven different cycles of God blessing his people. They take it for granted. They begin to sin and fall into rebellion. They turn to idolatry. As a result, their lives get all messed up. They become usually captive to some other nation. They get miserable. They get desperate. They cry out to God. He delivers them, and the cycle begins all over again. But overall, the whole book of Judges was a very dark time in the history of Israel, definitely discouraging time, a time when more often than not, the children of Israel, instead of experiencing God's blessing, they were suffering from the consequences of their own poor choices. And now as we come to the end of the book here, and Lord willing, we'll finish it tonight, we'll see. But beginning with chapter 17, we have a series of stories kind of related, not necessarily completely related, but that just, these stories show how low the children of Israel could go. And some of the awful things. There are some horrible elements to the stories that are in these chapters. And yet, it's the way God is. He records things the way it is. We might look at some of these things and say, why is this story in the Bible? Yuck. And really, the whole book of Judges is that way to some degree. But the fact is, God has to tell us the negative things because they're reality. It's what happens when we allow ourselves to deteriorate, to slip away from a closeness to the Lord. And boy, you see it here in these last chapters of Judges in a big way. It kind of starts out in chapter 17 at first being a compromise within the family. That develops into a spiritual compromise among leaders, religious leaders, and ultimately national compromise and failure in a big way, especially with the tribe of Benjamin. So we'll begin here with chapter 17. It says, there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, that were stolen, and you put a curse on the person who stole it, and I heard you say it, here's the silver with me, I took it. You have this family, and Micah says, hey, Mom, you know all that silver that someone stole from you and you put a curse on whoever stole it? I took it. Kind of strange, out of the blue. And listen to what his mother says. May you be blessed by the Lord, by Yahweh, my son. Oh, good. Now, this isn't some little kid. He has kids of his own. But it shows what's going on. I mean, spoiled offspring, definitely. She goes on to say, rather than to put a curse on him, now she says, oh, there's a blessing on you. And so when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver, his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you. Mom. She's going, yeah, I didn't want that to get stolen because it was something that I was dedicating to the Lord. I was going to make some idols for you. See how confused, see how messed up a family can get? You wonder why the kid ripped off his mom. Mom thinks a good thing to do to dedicate something to the Lord is for idolatry. It's like if you a kid stole money from his mom's purse today and he came and goes, oh, Mom, by the way, I stole the money from your purse. And she said, oh, that's okay, honey. That's all right. I was actually saving that money to subscribe to Playboy magazine for you. And so it's cool. Here, I'll be able to do that. As we read on, he returned the silver. His mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. The man Micah had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That comes up several times. It's kind of the theme of this book. So you have this family that's corrupted, that doesn't know the difference between blessing and cursing, that doesn't know the difference between being sold out to God and following after false gods, really messed up. Not understanding that stealing, what's wrong with that? It's, you know, it's kind of, well, bless you, nice job. You did a good job. You stole from me. I didn't catch you. Way to go. That's my boy. This is the mentality within the family. So it's no wonder that it carries over spiritually. And as Micah is confused, he's being given these gods, these idols. He's making his own. He's constructing a whole shrine, but it's supposed to be for God. Even though the law, right from the very first, says, don't have any graven images. Have no other gods before me. It's the most basic thing of the relationship with God of Judaism. And yet here he's doing this. But we get a clue when it says that he decided to consecrate one of his own sons to be his priest. Now what all this adds up to basically is that Micah was inventing his own religion. And we listen to that. We look at that and say, what? You're using stolen silver in order to create gods. Your mom is supporting you in this endeavor. And then you just pick one of your sons and go, abracadabra, you're a priest? And that's what you call worshiping God? That's the way you're going to do it? And yet really more and more, I think nowadays, people feel the liberty to make up whatever they want to believe. You hear people saying what they believe, and I'm amazed at some of the things that they think are acceptable. Now, there are certainly, in the last 100 years, there have been more religions made up than there ever was in the history of the world before that. All kinds of religions that think they have the answer, that they're providing the help. I had a woman come by to see me today, and she was, after a while, I could tell before she identified herself that she was from she was a Moonie. She was from the Sun Myung Moons organization, and so the Unification Church. But as she was talking to me, she was trying to get me pumped up on, they took this Israel trip, and a lot of different kinds of Christians got together, and they took a cross and buried it in the ground. And it's because the cross is so offensive to Muslims and Jews over there that it would be a good symbol to take the cross and bury it, because Jesus is alive, he's not dead anymore, and so therefore we can forget about the cross. And she said, well, the Catholic Church, they're the ones that started, you know, making a big deal about the cross in 400 AD, and she went into her whole spiel, and I thought, this is amazing. I finally told her, I said, you know, we're not going to get anywhere. You lost me when you said you buried the cross. But this is really important, she said, for all of us to be unified. I said, your church has been around like 70 years. The Church of Jesus Christ has been around over 2,000 years. And you think people are going to gather around a new religion like the Unification Church? And I said, besides that, if you really want to do something radical, why don't you get the Jews to put a Star of David and the Muslims to put a Quran or the Crescent and bury those? They'll kill you. I said, it's only the cross that you would even think of doing it to. And she said, but this movement is gaining momentum. I said, it's gaining momentum. Come on, the cross is on the front of every major magazine in the world. It's on every network. And you think a good idea right now is to bury the cross? And she said, well, I think that when people glorify the cross, I said, Paul said he glories in the cross. Jesus said, if I be lifted up, I'll draw them into myself, not if the cross is hidden. And so we went round and around a little bit, and I was just thinking, amazing that someone can just invent a religion, and a guy can just say, well, I think the cross is bad, so now we're all supposed to get rid of our crosses because this guy thinks that the cross is bad. It's a bad idea. It's divisive and so on. But you know, in every way, New Age religions are big this way. You can invent your own religion. Nowadays, the only tenet that your religion can't have is to say that it's correct and to say that anyone else is incorrect. As long as you think that everyone else can believe what they want and you believe what you want, you create your own God. And many people that I talk to, I'm amazed, their religious beliefs are just made up. And I often say to them, you've made up your own God. You've made up your own religion. And I hope your made up God has a heaven for you. Because the God of the Bible says some very specific things that need to happen in order for you to get there. And I hope that somehow your pretending is going to make hell bearable, because that's where you go if you won't give your life to Jesus Christ. But people just believe that it's all relative. We can make up our own faith. That's what was happening here. And invariably, as society becomes more tolerant of, you know, every kind of difference, as society emphasizes that everyone needs to just kind of make up their own beliefs, what they want to follow, who they want to worship, and how they want to worship, anytime society deteriorates to that level, you end up with polytheism, all kinds of gods, you end up with pantheism, everything is God, and ultimately morality goes down the drain and society will be destroyed. It's happened historically many, many times in the history of the world, and it certainly happened here. This little statement that says they didn't have a king and everybody did what was right in their own eyes is kind of an interesting one, because not having a king, it wasn't that, basically it wasn't that, oh, what they needed was a king. What they needed, we saw it when we studied Gideon, and the people wanted to make him king, and he said, no, you got to have God as your king. So the problem was, not only didn't they have God as their king, they had no structure at all. It was anarchy. At the same time, there was great personal liberty. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, liberty sounds like a good thing, and it is a good thing. It's an important value. We as Americans, of all people, understand the need for freedom. But when freedom is coupled with anarchy, you have problems. When structure goes by the boards and liberty is worshipped, you have, well, you have the Book of Judges. And that's a direction that our society seems to be going in as well. Talking a lot about freedom and liberty, but not respecting the need for structure in a society. It's what's happening with all these homosexual marriages in San Francisco. Now, it's not my big issues, homosexuals getting married. They can call themselves whatever they want. It doesn't have a great effect on me. But here's the thing. You have authorities who are condoning something that is illegal by the law of the land. And how can you continue to have any semblance of order if there's no one, no authority that stands, and then people just do whatever they want? So today they've decided that two men or two women can get married, contrary to what the law expresses. Well, what happens next week if you want to marry your poodle? You know, or you want to marry someone who's dead, or some adult wants to marry a child? Where do you draw the line? See, there's a need for structure. It's a reason why God ordained government. He wants to be at the head of it. But at the very least, someone has to put some structure in, because no ruling, anarchy in conjunction with liberty is a real problem. And that's what was happening here. So it says there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, and he was a Levite, and he was staying there. So he was staying near where Micah was, and this guy was of the Levitical tribe, the priestly line. And it says the man left the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. He was just hanging out, moving around, and he came to the mountains of Ephraim to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, where do you come from? And he said, oh, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm on my way to find a place to stay. I'm just, you know, kind of like then came Bronson looking for America or something. That's such an old reference. I'm sure most of you have no idea what I'm talking about. But Easy Rider, no, it's, never mind. He was just on the road. He was taking a road trip. And Micah said to him, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I'll give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes and your sustenance. So the Levite went in. Then the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as priest. Funny story. This guy Micah, this guy who had ripped off his mom, he worshipped idols, he made his kid his priest. I guess his kid wasn't doing very well as priest. Or maybe he was getting sick of it. Dad, I'm sick of being a priest. I don't want to be a priest. And so here is a Levite. And he's going, hey, this guy seems like a nice guy. He's a Levite. Maybe I'll hire him to be my personal priest. Just my little personal family priest. Now, the father of a family was supposed to have some sort of priestly rule over his family. The Levites were to serve the people of God in the order, in the structure that God had designed. Shouldn't go anywhere near idolatry or anything like that. And yet, the offer was just too good to turn down. Because he said, look, you want to be my personal priest? And he said, why would I want to be your personal priest? Well, because I'll pay you well. Oh, okay, that's different. Weird. Odd that he would even want to have a priest at all. But we see what happens. He thinks, now God's going to be good to me since I have a Levite as a priest. Basically, he was saying, I want you to be my priest as a good luck charm. And that's what he desired out of his religion. It's why he was fiddling with the idols. It's why he wanted to touch all the bases. Worship Jehovah, worship Yahweh. At the same time, have some of these other gods. Hey, whatever it takes, was basically his attitude. And if he could pay a little bit in order to have someone, you know, look over him spiritually, then fine, I'll put my money down. It's very similar to what a lot of people want to get out of church nowadays. Just to feel like this is going to make me lucky. This is going to put me in good standing with God. I'll throw a few bucks in the plate. I'll make friends with my pastor or, you know, my priest or whatever. I'll feel like I have a connection there. And basically, it's not going to affect the way I live. It's just, I'm going to do whatever I want, but I want to have a priest in my back pocket. I want to have someone who's there for me when I really need him. I have different people who have kind of looked on me that way in the past. It's funny. I don't hear from them for years. But then when something happens where they really need a pastor, somebody wants to get married or someone dies or something like that, boy, there they are popping up. I'm like their personal family priest. They don't pay me, but, you know, see, that was what religion had deteriorated into. You had a priest that could be bought. You had people that wanted religion as a good luck charm, and they didn't want it to intrude in the way that they live. We have to be careful. I think sometimes churches can get to the point where a pastor is just a hireling, where the people of the church are so into controlling the church that the pastor is just a guy that they can hire and fire at will. Just, okay, I don't like this one, move him on, bring in someone else. That's a danger. Because if a pastor feels like, oh, these people hire me, I need to please them, these people are my boss, then you're certainly not going to say something that might offend them. You're going to have the same freedom to minister as you have with your boss at work, to be honest with them. Now, you may have the kind of personality where you just say anything anyway, and that's, you know, frankly, tends to be my temperament. I don't worry too much about offending people. I don't worry about it as much as I should, really. I should be more concerned about that. But, I mean, they put me on live radio. I just think that's absolutely insane. But... And every once in a while, someone will remind me of, oh, I heard you on the radio. It was so funny when you told that guy, well, if you don't like it, get your own radio show. And think, that's not good. But I said to someone the other day, well, the show's called Pastor's Perspective. I'm a pastor. That's my perspective. Sorry. But there's a real danger when there's a minister for hire. When a minister sees a ministry as being his job and the people as being his bosses, you know, I could not take a step one way or the other if every time someone was upset with something I said, I thought, oh no, I need to change that. At some point, you put someone in a position of ministry because you hope they'll say something that bothers you. I mean, to me, if I listen to a pastor for very long and it doesn't bother me, then I figure I'm not getting anything out of it at all. If all I do is sit and listen to what someone says and just go, right on, amen, that's right, that's great, that's awesome, and they don't challenge me to think, and they can't call into question some of my practices and make me uncomfortable about them, then what good are they? But that was the role of this Levite, just like, let me be a yes man. Let me, as the New Testament puts it, people will look for... You know, there are people with itching ears that just want you to say what you want them to say. And I understand that. I don't enjoy alienating people. I don't like offending people with what I do. But at some point, you just have to do what's right. And to the extent to which I don't do that, and instead what I try to do is keep everyone happy, everyone loses. There I am, your little Levite for hire, making you feel good, hanging out and making your family feel comfortable, and never rocking your boat, never rattling your cage, and never speaking the truth of God to you. And that was the case here. And something that we need to be aware of, all of us personally, that we don't, as soon as someone says something we disagree with, run away from them. You know, write them off and go, I want to go find somebody that agrees with me. Not a good thing, not wise at all. We need, and it's as far as that goes, the same thing goes for friends. What good is a friend who just constantly says that they agree with you? First of all, if they always agree with you, it's either because they're lying or because they're really, really stupid and have never thought deeply enough to think differently than you. But friends are to be like iron sharpens iron. You don't want somebody arguing with you about everything. That's not necessary. But at the same time, as friends, we need to realize, as we are called as a kingdom of priests, we need people who will tell us the truth. We need someone who can let us know if there's something that they see that's going on that we don't see. It's what friends are for to a great extent. It's certainly what ministers are for. And Micah didn't get anything out of this Levite. It really, he was paying his money for nothing. He should have just, you know, bought some more gods with it, because as far as he was concerned, this Levite priest was about as good for him as any other good luck charm he had. In those days, there was no king in Israel, chapter 18. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. So the tribe of Dan, we know, we've read before, none of the tribes took all of the land that they should have taken. They all stopped short. At this point, though, the tribe of Dan was pretty frustrated because they didn't have much land. So they were looking for some easy pickings. They were looking for some place to conquer. And so it says they sent out 5 spies in chapter 2 and went from Zora and Eshtaol to spy out the land. And they said, go search the land. So they went to the mountains of Ephraim, where Micah lived, where this Levite lived. And they went to the house of Micah and stayed there. While they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. Something about his accent, they go, hey, you're a Levite, huh? He goes, yes. He had that austere kind of spiritual tone to his voice or something. They turned aside and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? They were curious. And he said, oh, here's the deal. Micah pays me. He has hired me and I've become his priest. So they said to him, please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we go will be prosperous. Again, they're going, oh, great, a good luck charm, a magic eight ball, an astrological predictor. Could you ask God if what we're doing is a good idea? Now, it doesn't say that he asked God. The priest just said, oh, go in peace. The presence of the Lord be with you on your way. Just real no frills, nice, friendly greeting of just, oh, bless you, my child. Like those people that bless animals and things like that. It's no more meaningful than that. They were asking for guidance from God. Could you ask God? And his attitude was, I don't need to ask God. I'm a Levite. I'm a family priest. I'm the head priest of this house. Let me bless you, my child. And just thoughtlessly kind of chattering a few meaningless words. And so they left and went to this town Laish and saw the people who were there and realized we can beat these people. So in verse 8, they came back to their brethren at Zora and they said, well, what's the deal? And they said, arise, let's go up against them. We've seen the land. It's very good. What, are you going to do nothing? Come on, don't hesitate. Let's go and enter and possess the land. We can take this little city. When you go, you'll come to a secure people and a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that's on the earth. This place is great. So 600 men of the family of Dan went from there, from Zora and Eshtaol, armed with weapons of war, and they went up and encamped in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. And so they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to Micah's house. So these soldiers that were going to go take this little city ended up at Micah's house. And the 5 spies said, hey, you know what? In that house right there, we stayed there. They've got some pretty cool stuff. Maybe you want to check it out. There's an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image. And they were like, well, the guy was nice to us, so we're not telling you to steal it. But now, therefore, consider what you should do. So they basically said, hey, the house over there, it's got some really cool idols in it. Now, think about it. They didn't have to think long. So they went over there, came to the house of the Levite, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. Hey, give me your stuff. Had all these weapons of war, and the five guys were standing aside, and when they entered, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, the molded image, verse 17, and the priest is standing there at the entrance to the yard. He's not going to lift a finger. Come on, he's a pastor. He's not going to actually work. If anything, you know, maybe help carry the stuff, but he's sure not going to fight against armed men. You know, he's a spiritual guy. And so it says, when they went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, and all those things, the priest said to them, hey, what's up? What are you doing? Not like challenging them, just like, interesting. You're ripping off the guy I work for. Wow. Imagine that. And they said, shut up. Be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. They're making them an offer. These are like headhunters. They're going, oh, we're taking this stuff, but look, if you just shut up and follow us, you can be our priest. Made him an offer. Is it better for you to be a priest to one house of a guy with no more gods, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel? And you can be big in the tribe of Dan. We're conquering this new city. This looks like a better job. This is a step up, definitely. Transfer over to our side. So this was really a tough dilemma for the priest, because being loyal to Micah and being committed to the ministry that he had, his heart was glad. He was like, let me think about it. Yeah, I'm going for it. And so he ends up picking up all the stuff they were stealing, and he took his place among the people. See you, Micah. They turned and departed and took kids and goods and all those sorts of things. When they got a ways away from Micah, the people, Micah's neighbors, got together and chased down the children of Dan. And they called out to the children of Dan and turned around and said to Micah, you know, what is the deal? What are you guys doing? You've got so many people together. You've taken away my gods, which I made, and the priest, you've gone away too. The priest is probably trying to act like he was being kidnapped, you know, but he was like carrying the stuff, so it made it kind of hard. How can you say to me, what ails you? And the children of Dan said, don't let your voice be heard among us. Get out of here. You're a dead man. And so the children of Dan went their way. And when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. He wasn't going to fight for his stuff. He knew he couldn't. He wasn't a fighter. He was a lazy guy who had been spoiled by his mom, who had learned to live by stealing, not by working. And there was nothing he could do to even protect himself or to protect his family. Just let him go. And so they took all those things and went to Laish, to those people, struck them with the sword, burned the city with fire, and basically took over the town. Changed the name of the city to Dan, even though it wasn't in the area of Dan, but because they were from Dan, that's what they called it. And then in verse 30, the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. So they set up at this new town. They had a priest and started a whole new priestly line with a guy named Jonathan. Now, we don't know if the unnamed Levite who went with them was actually this same Jonathan, or if something happened to that guy, maybe he got a better offer from a bigger city or whatever and got promoted, and then this Jonathan guy took over. It's pay your nickel, take your choice on it, really. I don't know. The interesting thing is this Jonathan, who was the priest who took over for the children of Dan there in Laish, he's the son of Gershom, who was the son of Manasseh, it says. Now, that's what it says in the Hebrew. There are several other translations, including in the Vulgate and some others, that instead of Manasseh, they say Moses. Now, the Hebrew word Manasseh and the Hebrew word Moshe, which is which is the name for Moses, there's just one letter difference. And we know that Moses' son was Gershom. And so most likely, highly likely, this Jonathan, who's working as a priest for the Danites, a pagan priest basically, was very likely the grandson of Moses. It's thought that the scribes couldn't bear to think of Moses' grandson as being involved in something so horrible, and so they just put one little mark above the letter, which turned it from being Moshe to being Manasseh. And so, well, I can't be absolutely positive about that, but it's likely that this guy is actually the grandson of the great Moses. The timing would have been about right, but what a horrible thing if that's the case. What an awful thing if this man Moses, who talked to God face to face like a friend, that two generations down the road, he's got a grandson who's selling himself out to the highest bidder, who's using what he has learned, and he certainly would have learned a lot if he was Moses' grandson, using that information in order to worship idols. It's not that big of a surprise. Moses' brother, Aaron, made the golden calf while Moses was receiving the law from the Lord up on Mount Sinai. But here, things have deteriorated so much that one who knew better was selling himself out. It's too bad. It happens a lot in ministry. It's amazing how many godly people, when you look at their kids and their grandkids, they go way off from where, you know, their forefathers were. Just a long ways away from the level of commitment. And it's a sad thing, but it's also kind of an indictment on some of the godly people that they aren't able to pass that on. Of course, you can't force it on. It's something that you have to exemplify, and you hope your kids, your grandkids, discover it for themselves. You can't just make them be believers. You can't make them be committed. But often, sad to say, people are so busy serving God that they don't provide the best example for their children and their grandchildren. And a couple of generations down the road, they fall quite a ways off from what God ultimately wanted to do in their lives. So that was happening there with the children of Dan. Now it said, now in chapter 19, it shifts gears to an unrelated situation here, a different Levite. And it says, it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim, same kind of area, probably a different time. And he took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Oh, that's good. This priest has a live-in girlfriend. But his concubine played the harlot against him. Big surprise. She went off and had an affair and was prostituting herself, and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for four whole months. Then her husband arose and went after her. He waited 4 months. Then he started, I guess nothing better came along, and so he started thinking, man, I mean, she's not much, but 4 months. So he tries to go get her back and sweet talk her. And it says he went to speak kindly to her and bring her back, having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him. Figured he could bribe her into coming back. Went to the father's house. The father was really glad to see him because he doesn't want his daughter moving back home, and it'd be hard to marry her off to someone else. So he's like, oh, good. You know, look, honey, your husband's here. And the father-in-law detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. They ate and drank and lodged there. It came to pass on the fourth day that they got up early in the morning and were going to leave, and the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, oh, refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way. He goes, first, have some breakfast. Come on, let me cook you some French toast. They sat down, the two of them ate and drank together. One thing led to another, and the woman's father said, oh, you ought to spend the night. You know, you shouldn't be driving in this condition, and let your heart be merry. Look, just party for the night. You can always leave tomorrow. And so he wanted to depart, but the father-in-law kept saying, no, no, no. So he stayed again. And then he got up early in the morning on the fifth day, and the young woman's father said, oh, refresh your heart. You need a drink. And so they delayed until afternoon. Both of them ate. Carbohydrates were kicking in. They were getting tired. And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law said to him, come on, look, it's afternoon, it's late afternoon, it's drawing towards evening, come on, just spend the night. And so this goes on for a while, and finally the guy says, I'm not willing to spend the night. He finally took off. He goes, we've been here long enough. And so they took off, and as they were traveling through, they didn't want to stop in any of the pagan cities because it probably wouldn't have been safe. But finally they were pressing on towards Gibeah, and they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. So they were near this town, Gibeah, which was a Jewish town from the tribe of Benjamin. They turned aside to go to lodge at Gibeah, and when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city because no one would take them into his house to spend the night. They looked on him as kind of a foreigner because he was from another area, even though they were Jews. Normally, they would be real hospitable, but they looked on him as being kind of a hick and wouldn't give him a place to stay. But an old man came along after working all day in the field, and he was from the same mountains of Ephraim where this unnamed Levite was. So he said, oh, come on and stay at my house. And so, the old man said, peace be with you, verse 20. Let all your needs be my responsibility. Just don't spend the night in the open square. Now, that was partly, certainly this man's concern was partly just being hospitable, but it was partly because he knew what that open town square was like at night. This was a pretty wild bunch of people that lived here. And so I think he was basically saying, this is not the neighborhood that you want to camp out in. So why don't you come to my house? Brought him into his house and fed the donkeys, washed their feet, ate and drank. And so then, as they were enjoying themselves, certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him carnally. These guys, it's very similar to the story of Lot, as when in Sodom, the angels came to Lot's house, and the guys from Sodom surrounded the house and were saying, hey, send those guys out. We want to know them. And again, that's a euphemism for being intimate with them. They didn't want to just introduce themselves. Hello, my name is, they had something more in mind for that. And the man who was the master of the house went out and said, no, my brethren, I beg you, don't act so wickedly. This guy's come to my house. He's a guest. Don't commit this outrage. Again, it was a big deal to them to be hospitable and to treat their guests properly. But you see how they treat women. It's not quite as good in verse 24. Look, here's my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let them bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please. But to this man, don't do such a vile thing. How sad. These guys preferred. They wanted the men. They wanted a man to come out so that they could get involved with them. The idea of a woman, they were thinking, well, what are we going to do with a woman? But ultimately, they wouldn't listen. And so he took the concubine. He hung on to his daughter. And he sent her out, and they abused her. They knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light. So she's laying there on the doorstep after just being brutalized and basically gang raped by these perverts. And it says, when her master rose in the morning doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine and fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold, hanging there trying to get in the door. He said to her, get up and let's be going, sensitive guy. But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. He goes, took her body, basically, and laid it across the donkey and headed back home. When he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. Cut her up into 12 pieces and sent one piece to each of the 12 tribes. You start to think, these people are civilized? Wait, this is a Levite? This is a priest? Somebody in the, who's supposed to be interceding between God and man doing something like this? But I'll tell you, when God's people become twisted, then again, it starts out with families getting messed up, but gradually you'll see ministers getting messed up as well. Ultimately, that leads to the fall of a whole nation. And that's what had happened, and this is just a graphic picture of it. So he mails out 12 pieces of prostitute to the 12 tribes. And it says, so it was that all who saw it said, oh man, I've never seen anything like this before. Consider it, confer, and speak up, he said. You guys need to do something about this. So basically what he was doing was letting all the tribes of Israel know what had been done there in the city, and to demand that they need to respond in some way. He's basically saying, I need your help, but I have here, you open the package and you see this gross piece of flesh, and it gets your attention and you realize, okay, we need to think of something to do. And so as we come to chapter 20, it says, all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, as well as from the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. So this was shocking enough that even these people who had walked away from the Lord, even these people who weren't really serving God, who were following idols and things like that, they thought, you know, even I didn't think it could get this bad. This got their attention, and they drew together. And often, God will use a horrible catastrophe to cause people to draw together. And you hope that they draw together and turn to the Lord. I think of the disaster that happened on 9/11 when our two jets were crashed into the Twin Towers, into the World Trade Center in New York City. All of a sudden, we were shocked, we were stunned. I'll never forget that morning as long as I live. My son William came and woke me up, and he said, and we had been to the Twin Towers just, you know, a year or two before that, and Will had gone to sleep with his TV on, and he woke up, and he came in, and he goes, Dad, a plane crashed into the World Trade Center. And so I went in his room with him. We sat there on the bed and watched, and the newsmen were saying, yes, every indication is that it's an accident. And I'm looking at the picture, and there's like 500 miles visibility in New York City. It's 9 o'clock in the morning there. And I said, William, this wasn't an accident. And as we were talking and watching the picture, the second airplane crashed into it. And you had that feeling like a kick in the gut. It was, what is going on here? This is crazy. And then as the news footage came in, as the day unfolded, and we saw graphic pictures of people leaping to their deaths from tall buildings and things like that, you just think, what is going on? And at that time, all of a sudden, the door's wide open to the gospel. All of a sudden, people are coming to church like they never have before because they're shocked, they're disturbed, they're upset. They didn't really think it could get this bad. But it did, and it was. But people get over it after a while. It's just kind of the way it works. If God sends you an attention getter and it doesn't get your attention for real, you don't really change, then it'll take something else. It'll take something worse. So in this case, they all did get together finally before the Lord. And the leaders and all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God. And it says, the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. Then the children of Israel said, tell us, how did this wicked deed happen? So what happened? So the Levite told the story. We were down there in Gibeah, which is a town that belongs to Benjamin. Went there to spend the night, and these guys did this, told them what happened, killed my concubine. So I mailed pieces of her out. She was dead already, and I wanted you guys to see how awful this is. Verse 7, look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now. Are you guys going to stand up, or are we just going to let something like this happen? So they got up as one man and said, none of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We're going to head out and we're going to take Gibeah and we're going to destroy Benjamin. And so verse 11, all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united together as one man. Then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what is this wickedness that has occurred among you? They sent messengers throughout Benjamin. Now, therefore, deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. But the children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. So they tried to say, look, we don't want to wipe out Benjamin. You're our brother. Just turn over the guys that did this. But amazingly, the people from Benjamin said, forget it. We're not going to do it. though the rest of Israel was shocked by this horrible thing, their own people wouldn't turn them in. They weren't shocked at it. They didn't see the horror of it. It's something that more and more we really deal with in our society, in law enforcement and military both. It's hard to get people who believe in what's right enough that they'll put themselves out on the limb a little bit in order to point the finger at someone who's done something awful. So you go into an area, someone's been murdered, and nobody knows anything. Nobody saw anything. Nobody heard anything. It's what happens to a society that doesn't care. Where there's no God, where everyone does what's right in his own eyes, we just don't want to be involved. And so you can have a person being beaten out on the street in plain view in the middle of the day, people walking by, stepping over the body, and no one bothering to call and help. No one willing to step in and defend a person who's being attacked. It's a sick world, but that's the way it was with the Benjamites. They were just going, no, we're not going to narc on them. We're not going to turn anybody. Oh, we're not stool pigeons. It was that kind of mentality. And so the Benjamites got together and said, we'll fight you. And they had some good soldiers. The children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword. Besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who was another 700 like special forces people. And among all these people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. So they had this special group of guys that with slingshots that could split a hair, were so accurate, and they were all left-handed. I don't know what the significance of that is, but some of the greatest pitchers in baseball have been southpaws, so maybe there's something to that. If you're a left-handed person, you can feel good about it, except that all these lefties died. But so Israel had 400,000 men who drew the sword. So you have, 26,000 and some change Benjamites who are saying, we'll fight Israel 400,000 strong. Arrogance, foolishness. The children of Israel rose up and went to the house of God to inquire of God. They said, God, tell us what to do. And they said, which of us shall go first to battle? They didn't say, should we do this? God, is this really a good idea? They were going, God, here's what we're doing. Now, can you just tell us who to go first? Asking for God's little rubber stamp, like God is their rent-a-priest, And so God says, okay, send Judah first. So they send Judah out, and they got wiped out by the Benjamites. Couldn't fight. Children of Benjamin came down and cut down to the ground 22,000 men of the Israelites. And so the people, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves. Oh, you were lucky. That was a sucker punch. And so they're going, we can do this. Put themselves in array. And then they went up and wept before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, shall I draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? And the Lord said, fine, do what you want to do. So they went up to Benjamin again, went out on the second day, and they were cut down to the ground, 18,000 more. All these drew the sword. Then the children of Israel started getting concerned. All the people went up. Everyone now says, we need to all be in this. It can't just be a few token people asking God, if we're going to make it, we're going to have to stick together. As Benjamin Franklin said, if we don't hang together, we will for sure hang separately. They understood it. They said, we need everyone to be involved. It's a good feeling when people get involved, but they went up before the house of God and they wept like they did before. And they sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. See, they hadn't done that before. They really didn't invest anything. At first, they just said, hey, God, what do you think? Who should go first? He goes, doesn't matter to me, take Judah. They went and got wiped out. Then they go, God. And he goes, okay, fine, go ahead. They get wiped out again. Now they're saying something's missing here. So they all got together. They again are weeping, but this time they're saying, we're going to deny ourselves. We're going to fast and pray. And as we do that, not only that, we're going to sacrifice. The whole idea of sacrifice, as we talked about this last Sunday, it's a picture of the fact that Jesus Christ was going to have to give himself. So really, when they sacrifice, they're saying, we can't do this. We are insufficient to run the show. We need a help of one greater than we are. basically, we want to go in the power of the Lord Jesus Christ. And you know, we have a choice, and we have a tendency to do this too. You know, an opportunity will come up or a need will come up, and we'll just go, okay, God, please bless, help me. And then we get smashed. It just doesn't go well. We're getting killed. So then we start crying and complaining about it, and we pray a little bit longer. And then now we're ready. We get pumped up. Maybe we hear a good motivational speaker or, you know, a great story, or listen, maybe put on the Rocky theme song and da-da-da. And we're like, okay, now we can do it. And we head out and we get cut off at the knees again. And then finally, we start to fast and pray. And we come as living sacrifices, presenting ourselves. We come acknowledging who Jesus is, and we go, God, I don't know what, I'll do anything that you want me to do. If you just want me to lose, I'll lose. But Lord, I come to you. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to lay my plans out for you, my battle plans, and ask you to bless them. I'm really desperate. And as God's people bind together, as we realize we need to be together in this, and as we come with that sacrifice and that fasting and praying, then something happens as it did for them. And finally, as you read on, God said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. And so they set up this whole military ambush and everything. And interestingly, as they sent some people up there, it says in verse 34, the Benjamites did not know that disaster was upon them. They thought they'd still get away with it. See, the enemies of God, they can win to an extent that they just assume they're always going to get away with it. But it's not going to happen that way. Sometimes our enemies will win against us. Sometimes the enemy will make strides in the program that he wants to do as he attacks us. But it's only because our hearts aren't in the place that they need to be. That God wants to use our enemies in order to cause us to purify our hearts before him, to learn to fast and pray, to learn to seek his face, to learn what sacrifice is all about. And as soon as we've learned what we need to learn, those people that got cocky beating us down, taking advantage of us, using us, well, they'll get their day, and that's what happened to the Benjamites. And so it doesn't say Israel defeated them. Verse 35, the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel. And the children of Israel destroyed that day 25,100 Benjamites, all these that drew the sword. So the children of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. They ran and they were chased and they were ambushed everywhere. And basically, they ended up with 500 guys that were left. The Benjamites were chased and towards the east and towards the west. And they fled to the wilderness, to the rock of Rimmon. Pursued them relentlessly up to get them and killed 2,000 of them there. And so actually 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. They stayed there in the rock of Rimmon for 4 months, verse 47. So 600 guys are left of the men of Benjamin. What a sad thing. Benjamin, remember who their ancestor was? Benjamin was the favorite son, really. Of Jacob. He was the youngest son. He was the one that Jacob was hanging on to when Joseph had been taken away. Benjamin, the one who ultimately, as he came to Egypt, before they knew who Joseph was, remember, it was their little brother. And in one of the touching scenes where Joseph was certainly moved, as he saw that his brother's hearts had been changed, before his brother's years before, 20 years before, had sold him into slavery. But now he sees, as Judah says, let me go to jail. Please let Benjamin go. Judah, from whose tribe Jesus came, Jesus was the lion of the tribe of Judah. Judah, the big brother to Benjamin, said, let me be your substitute. I'll look out for you. And after that, Judah was always protecting Benjamin. In fact, as you look at the map of where the tribes were, the tribe of Judah was a big area and Benjamin was stuck right in the middle. It was like, Judah, I'll protect Benjamin, my little brother. But here, Benjamin had done something so awful. They were going against, to battle against the children of God. And now they end up with 600 guys left, and it's awful. And so the last chapter, the children of Israel are mourning. They're bummed. They're going, look, it's one of our tribes, and now they're just about extinct.
The people came to the house of God, verse 2, and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly and said, O Lord God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel? So they began to struggle. You read on and it says that they had all made a deal already. All of the tribes had said, we are not going to allow our daughters to marry Benjamin guys. They already had this bad reputation and they had already made this commitment. We're not going to let our daughters marry guys from Benjamin. But now you have 600 guys and that's all that's left of the tribe of Benjamin. And how are they going to get wives? They're stuck there in a cave and it doesn't matter what you do. They can't marry Jewish girls. This tribe is done for. And so they began to put their heads together and think, what can we do? It's time to preserve the tribe of Benjamin. And so they found out that there was this one area, Jabesh-Gilead, where when they went to war, it says in verse 8, and they said, what one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord? And in fact, no one had come to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead. So they started noticing, who's here? And they're going, wait a minute, Jabesh-Gilead, those guys are missing. They didn't show up in this thing. So they went and the congregation went out, sent 12,000 people and went and wiped out Jabesh-Gilead. Except they saved all the women who were virgins. And they said, okay, these gals will marry the Benjamites in order to preserve the tribe. And so the whole congregation, verse 13, sent word to the children of Benjamin who were at the Rock of Rimmon and announced peace to them. So they came down and their prize was these women who were probably bitter and upset. And you can imagine all these 600 guys marrying women that were had just lost their families. It wouldn't be much of a honeymoon, but there still weren't enough is the problem. And so in verse 16, the elders said, well, what are we going to do for wives for those that remain? We didn't even get 600. We couldn't find 600 virgins in Jabesh-Gilead. I don't know if it's a comment on the neighborhood or not, but basically they couldn't even find 600 eligible women in that area. So what do we do? So they came up with this scheme. And this is so typical of the book of Judges. It's an appropriate way for the story to end. It's the kind of thing that when people put their heads together and plan something without God speaking to them, they come up with an idea like this. It's kind of like Lucy and Ethel at their worst. Just, well, I have an idea. So they came up with this idea. They're going, hey, over in Shiloh, they're always having, every year they have this big feast. And one of the big features of the feast is it's a dance. So let's invite the Benjamites that didn't get a Jabesh-Gilead girl and tell them, hey, the dance is going to be over in this area. Here's what you do. You sneak out of the bushes. You invite one of these girls to dance from Shiloh. And when you're dancing, just waltz them right off the dance floor and take off with them. And they're going, oh, right. You know, that's going to go over really good with their families. They're going, no, no, no. We'll smooth things out. See, here's the thing. We all want the tribe of Benjamin to survive, but we've already promised that we won't give our daughters to be married to Benjamin. But, wink, wink, if you stole them, what could we do? So they have this dance. And the rest of these Benjamites go and pick out women at the dance and haul them off. And that's basically how the story ends. Amazing. Children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. It's a reason why Christians shouldn't dance. No, not really. I'm just kidding. Then they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the cities and dwelled in them. So the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. And again, the epitaph over the book of Judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Before that, there was a king in Israel. It was God. But in those days, no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The book of Judges, some weird stories, some gross things. You remember from just a few weeks ago, everything from a left-handed guy who sticks a dagger in a king that was so fat that the fat closed over the dagger and he couldn't pull it out, killing him while the people thought he was on the toilet. Stories of
Samson being used over and over again, foolishly. Gideon being a chicken with what he's doing. Jephthah offering to sacrifice his daughter. It goes and goes and goes, and all the gross things that happened in these chapters tonight. You guys, that's the way the world will be if we don't have a king and if we all do what's right in our own eyes. If we don't submit ourselves to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, we'll never have peace. It's not going to be a peaceful time. It's not going to be a prosperous time. God can't bless us. God can't give us peace until the Prince of Peace reigns. And it doesn't start with our nation. It doesn't start with our world. It doesn't come down to, well, we really need to get missions going. No way. It starts in our families. It starts when we begin to live lives of integrity before God and before our families. And then it spreads out to our local friends and our neighbors and our community and our church and other churches. And that's the way it's designed to function. When people see what it's like to have God as their king, it changes everything. It doesn't really matter then who the human rulers are, because God's in charge. He's running the show. He's calling the shots. Anything less than that, you're either going to have a king who's a tyrant, destroying your life. You'll have a king who's so weak that he's following people rather than leading people. Or it'll be absolute anarchy. But at any rate, a society, a church, a family, where everybody just does what's right in their own eyes, is doomed to failure. And the book of Judges stands eternally as a monument to what happens when people do their own thing. Just do whatever seems like a good idea. Doing what comes naturally. What comes naturally is death, devastation, destruction, betrayal, bloodshed. That's what happens when left to our own devices. The world needs personal examples of people who allow God to rule in their lives. And that's our opportunity. That's our calling. Let's pray. Lord, frankly, after some of the stories that we read tonight, for me, after studying these over the last couple of weeks, I'm sick of the book of Judges. I really am. It's sick. It's gross. It's sad. But it's sad also because it just strikes so close to home. We're concerned for our nation. Not only that, though. Concern for our families, for our church, for each of us individually. God, we need you to be our king. We acknowledge now you are the king. We don't want to do what's right in our own eyes. We don't want to play little religious games. We don't want to hire a pastor. We don't want to believe what we want to believe just to protect our own ability to just do what we want to do. But God, where we're wrong, we need to be confronted. Where we are failing, we need your help. And we present ourselves to you, desiring for you to truly be the Lord, the King of our lives. Not for us to be the master of our own fate, captain of our own soul, but to be your servants, to follow you tenaciously, obediently, to go where you call us to go, to do what you call us to do. We need your help. And we don't want to be those who just ritually ask for your help and then do whatever we want. God, we are serious about hearing from you. And we will pray and we will fast. And Lord, we will present ourselves as a sacrifice. We'll lay our own desires on the altar so that we can hear your voice say, now go. This is going to work. You're going to win. I'm going to fight for you. Lord, help us to do that, each of us, individually, corporately. And we thank you for being honest with us. The Bible would have been okay if you had left all this gross stuff out, but it probably wouldn't have hit us in the same way. And we know that we need to have our cage rattled. And you've done that, and we thank you. And we love you, and we're depending on you. We know you're not depending on us. Help us not to depend on ourselves, but on the one who made us. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.